Welcome to This Month in Muscular Dystrophy. I'm Kevin Flanagan from the Center for Gene Therapy at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. Each month on this podcast, we invite authors of recent publications to discuss how their work improves our understanding of inherited neuromuscular diseases and what their work might mean for the treatment of these diseases. We're very fortunate today to have as our guest Professor Kate Bushby from the International Center for Life and the Institute of Human Genetics at the University of Newcastle upon Tyne. Dr. Bushby is a distinguished researcher in the field of neuromuscular disease with a career that's really been dedicated to characterizing both the molecular characterization of muscular dystrophies, but also to the clinical characterization of muscular dystrophies. And one of her current roles is as the coordinator for TREAT-NMD, which is a European effort to, actually an international effort, to establish the infrastructure to really move forward the therapies for these disorders. So, Dr. Bushby, it's a great pleasure, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
We're going to talk today about two recent papers from January and February of this year. And to our listeners, you can find links to the abstracts of these papers on our website at nationwidechildrens.org/muscular-dystrophy-podcast. The links are there to both of these papers, and these are papers that discuss Duchenne muscular dystrophy and develop care standards for these. So could we begin by talking a little bit about the prevalence and the impact of Duchenne muscular dystrophy?
Well, Duchenne muscular dystrophy is one of the most common types of muscular dystrophy. It affects mainly boys. They usually present when they're around 2, 3, or 4 years of age. And they have muscle weakness, which shows up as difficulty with walking, jumping, climbing stairs, and so forth. And this weakness, unfortunately, gets worse as time goes by, so they need to use a wheelchair at some stage, usually in their teenage years, and unfortunately also is life-limiting because of the complications it has in the respiratory and the heart muscles. And there are about 1 in 3,500 little boys are born with this condition, so it's not an uncommon condition amongst the different types of inherited muscle diseases.
Your papers are about developing care standards for this disorder. Why is it necessary to define standards of care?
Well, I think over the last few years, people have really come to realize that doing something about the complications of Duchenne really makes a difference to the patients and their families. In the olden days, the way that people were diagnosed with Duchenne was very much saying, well, we're very sorry, this is a very horrible disease, it's untreatable and there's nothing we can do about it, so go away and love your child. And that's just not acceptable nowadays, because we know that there are ways to manage and treat the complications that come along with Duchenne, even if the curative therapies that we're all waiting for aren't yet quite in the clinics.
That's right. So while these curative therapies are under development and in clinical trials, some of them now entering clinical trials, they don't necessarily, they're not designed at the moment to help all boys with Duchenne dystrophy, and these standards of care really provide a framework for giving the best possible treatment, don't they, for boys of with this disorder?
They do, and I mean, we're very, very clear from the work that's been done by patient organisations in particular that there are wide discrepancies in the care that's offered to patients with Duchenne, both within countries and between countries. So the best clinics are great and they don't need these care standards. They already work to this standard or even beyond. But we don't want the care of Duchenne to be a lottery. Every child with Duchenne, every young person with Duchenne should have access to the best available care. And by getting standards like this out, it means that people have a tool to lobby their health authorities to get the care they need, and that doctors can really all begin to work together to make life better for these patients.
And so this paper really is a guideline not only for parents when they go to see their doctor, but also guidance I see for primary care physicians who may not see a large number of these patients to help them collate information about what's the current status of best care, and muscular dystrophy specialists as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this paper really is destined for a wide audience. As you say, general practitioners or the primary care physicians, they may see one or no patients with Duchenne through their lifetime. So when they get presented with a family, this just gets all the information they need in one place to be sure that the care that their patient is getting is appropriately coordinated.
I imagine, too, variation in standard of care represents a challenge for planning clinical trials. Is that right, that if patients are treated very fundamentally differently in different countries or different areas across the country, that makes it difficult to assess the impact of new therapies?
That's another very important reason for the introduction of care standards. Just looking at the way trials are planned in Duchenne, we know immediately that we're going to need to have multi-center international trials of any of these different therapies. And if you're going to be comparing like with like, you have to have a baseline that everybody can recognize is the correct one in order to make sure that what you're seeing is the impact of your drug and not just the fact that somebody is getting a different process of physiotherapy or whatever is making a difference.
Well, tell us a little bit about these papers and the process that was used in them to develop these clinical care recommendations.
This is a very long process and very rigorous in order to try and make sure that the recommendations were truly representative of a broad spectrum of clinical excellence and not merely reflecting one person's opinion. We did that very deliberately in order to try and make sure that they could carry weight and authority across the community and provide a very rational and multifaceted level of standard of care. So the whole process was driven and organised by the Centres for Disease Control. They were funded through the MD Care Act in order to get together a group of over 80 experts. And these experts were supported by a coordinating committee which included representatives of the major patient organisations as well. And these committees assessed the different areas, the different domains of care in Duchenne, and came up with recommendations via a process of achieving consensus, which was over three rounds and really took a number of years to get established.
This consensus-building process, does it have particular strengths versus weaknesses? Does anything get left out of an analysis like this? Or conversely, are there things that get into it that shouldn't?
Interesting way to think about it is to say, okay, what we really did with this process was to think about clinical scenarios, actually dissect out the progression of a child with Duchenne in great detail across the whole lifespan with all of these different specialties contributing. And so at every stage, the clinical questions were addressed as to whether a particular intervention was appropriate, necessary, or inappropriate. There are, of course, weaknesses in that process because you can't think of everything when you start out. You really, you know, you set yourself your parameters and then halfway down the road or at the end of the road, you realize that you've maybe not addressed something which actually you feel was quite important. Also, because the process took so long, things arose over the generation of the care standards, which probably we hadn't even considered as a problem at the beginning or as an issue that we needed to address. So it has to be said that these care guidelines, although they represent the state of the art just now, have to be seen as a dynamic document, which will require updating and input from new standards and new trials and new pieces of information as they go forward.
Can we talk just about a couple of the recommendations of the group, just as examples for our listeners? One is recommendations regarding the use of corticosteroids, and that's in corticosteroids like the use of prednisone or deflazacort are in fairly widespread use, but they're not universally used even today. Is that right?
Yeah, there's definite variation in the way people utilize corticosteroids with different regimes used and with some people, as you say, just not even using them at all, not even offering them at all.
So this review, certainly the current recommendations for care would be starting one of these regimens and, in fact, give detailed guidelines in the review for considerations in choosing that or changing from one to the other.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that people worry about with corticosteroids is the burden of side effects. And clearly that's something which has to be addressed in great detail if you're going to start a child on what's going to be a long-term treatment with a drug that does have significant adverse effects possible. So built into the document is not only a clear discussion of when to start steroids and how to carry on with them, but also to think about the side effects of steroids in a very proactive way. So to look out for ways that you can prevent side effects happening and then manage them if they do occur. Because the one thing you can say about steroids is that they've been around for a very long time and we know what the side effects might be. This is quite different to the new drugs that we have great hope for. We have no idea what their side effects will be. So we, at least with steroids, we can look out for the side effects that we know might happen and work hard to try and prevent or manage them.
It's interesting to me that the second domain covered, if you will, is the psychosocial issues, which even as a clinician, I recognize sometimes we, as the community, may neglect that as a real treatment. We may neglect it as one of the primary considerations in this disease. Could you address a little bit the psychosocial aspects of this?
Well, if you talk to families, one of their main considerations is, how is my son getting on at school? How is he interacting with his friends? How is he growing up? What kind of independent adult is he going to be? And if you don't start addressing that very early on in Duchenne, you can actually miss the boat and end up with people who don't have the opportunities that they might otherwise enjoy. So that's why we put together a very experienced psychosocial panel led by somebody who's not only a psychologist but also a parent of a child with Duchenne. And that panel really for the first time provided guidance on how to go about, first of all, recognizing the problems which may come along with Duchenne, and secondly, using well-established methods to try and help with those problems. And I think just getting this out on the table, making it one of the core recommendations of the group, is going to have a great impact on families, because this is one of the areas where they can really struggle to cope and struggle to have recognition of the problems that can come along with the condition.
The second of the papers addresses other multidisciplinary aspects of the disease, including physical therapies and surgical interventions, cardiac management. I wanted to highlight one, though, in particular, respiratory management, which is addressed in the second paper. And to highlight that because I know of your own work published in 2007 from your experience in the Newcastle Clinic. I think maybe you could discuss for a moment that example. It's quite illustrative, I think, of how the management tools at hand can really change the course of this disease.
Yeah. So we published a couple of papers in, I think, 2001 and then 2007, looking at how the impact of respiratory support had changed the survival rates in Duchenne. And these were showing that really you're now looking at increased survival beyond what could be achieved before the institution of ventilation as a way to help breathing in Duchenne, an improvement in length of life of up to 10 years. And I think this is something which we ignore at our peril, because, you know, if we were able to show that gene therapy improved longevity by 10 years, this would be such a big story. We really have to take into account the fact that we have a very good way to treat the breathing problems that come along with Duchenne. And provided we're very cautious about the way we assess these people and the way we institute treatments in a staged manner, we can really have a huge impact. And the paper goes into that, simplifies that, by showing exactly what assessments are relevant at each particular stage of the condition, and then by showing that as the condition progresses, there are very simple ways that you can go about improving and enhancing the respiratory function of these people, ultimately with the provision of nocturnal ventilation.
Well, what has the response to your article been in the patient community and parent community?
We've had a lot of very good feedback. We have several patient organisations who are joining with us in a project which we call CareNMD, which is all about the ability to translate these care standards into practical applications in the clinic. And this is something which we're very excited about. We've had patient organisations from across the world volunteering to translate the family guide, which we've produced on the back of the original articles, into their own languages. And overwhelmingly, what we've seen is that this is a tool for lobbying health authorities and national bodies in order to make sure that the need for coordinated care in Duchenne is really recognised and that this gets onto everybody's agenda as they plan their health services.
Thank you for taking the time to talk with us about this work, and thank you for taking the lead in preparing these documents, which I know will be a great a tool for parents and their families throughout the world. I appreciate your time today and for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you. I mean, I think it's we have to emphasize that this was a huge collaborative effort, supported by many, many different people from different disciplines and from across the patient community as well. And, you know, really the support from all of these groups was essential in order to get this piece of work together, which I think hope will really improve things for these people.
Well, thanks again for participating. And I just want to point out to our listeners that full text of these articles and the family guide prepared in relation to them are available from the TreatNMD website. The link to that website can be found at our website, at nationwidechildrens.org/muscular-dystrophy-podcast. This podcast has been brought to you by Nationwide Children's Hospital. Thanks for joining us, and be sure to check back with us next month.